A never-ending crisis today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Boston's former cardinal Bernard Law has died in Rome. He was the face of the crisis of pedophile priests in the Catholic Church. How did he become the face of this crisis?
He became the face because he did nothing about the crisis.
And how the abuse scandal that first came to light in Boston continues around the globe.
Two archbishops in Australia right now are undergoing prosecution for cover-up.
Also, Rhode Island used to buzz with factories punching out costume jewelry for the rest of the world. Then came globalization and lots of lost jobs.
The industry changed. They worked as hard as they could and still changed on them.
But one company hangs on. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Glad you could make it here today. Since we went on the air in 1996, there have been a handful of big international stories that originated right here in our city. The Boston Marathon bombing in 2013, of course. Two of the hijacked 9/11 planes took off from here. And that same year, 2001, the Boston Globe started reporting on some disturbing revelations in the Catholic Church, pedophile priests. It turned out to be a story that had implications around the world. Today, the man at the center of that scandal has died. His name was Bernard Law. He was a cardinal when he was head of the Boston Archdiocese and one of the most powerful American leaders in the Catholic Church. After the scandal broke, we saw the reality of what Law had been partly responsible for, reinforcing a system that gave impunity to thousands of priests who'd committed sexual abuse. Philip Martin, my colleague here at WGBH, is one of the many reporters who've covered this story over the last two decades. Also joining us is Anne Barrett Doyle with Bishop Accountability. It's an independent watchdog group that was founded as a result of the Boston Catholic Church crisis. Welcome to you both. Anne, let me start with you. Just remind us of how explosive the scandal within the church was. Was there a moment for you when you realized just the magnitude of this crisis?
When the Boston Globe actually began its huge front page stories, it was actually January 2002. That first story appeared, fittingly enough, on the Feast of the Epiphany, a Catholic feast day. It was absolutely shocking to Catholic parents like myself that Cardinal Law had known that this pedophile priest, John Gagan, was abusing children, and he kept him in ministry. But at that time, Marco, we thought that it was just John Gagan, you know, that was the only priest that Cardinal Law had mismanaged. By the end of 2002, thanks to litigation and brave victims coming forward, we understood that he had mismanaged more than 100 abusers in the Boston Archdiocese, knowing that children were gravely hurt as a result. It was indeed a massive betrayal of children and a criminal cover-up.
Philip, Law was never accused of sexual abuse himself. How did he become the face of this crisis?
He became the face because he did nothing about the crisis. When the Boston Globe spotlight team and before it, the Boston Phoenix, shed light on this issue, Cardinal Law essentially tried to cover up the scandal. Way before the scandal broke, he had been transferring priests to different parishes and essentially protecting these priests. So as the person in charge, if you will, the boss, the CEO for the fourth largest archdiocese in the United States, he became the person responsible for doing nothing. So from having a reputation as someone, you know, like who stood by the poor and the disenfranchised, he became a pariah.
And right in my own neighborhood in Cambridge, there is a church across the street that is now condominiums because the church had to settle for the lawsuits. Tell us more about the legal consequences for both Law and the Catholic Church.
So the legal consequences for Law were nothing, as Philip said. Despite, I think, a good faith effort by the Attorney General at the time, the Attorney General said, we cannot find a law on the books right now that would allow us to prosecute Cardinal Law. Philip, I don't know if you remember, but when Cardinal Law took off in mid-December 2002, he suddenly had vanished, and no one knew where he went. This was right before he resigned. It turns out that he fled to the Vatican just hours before Attorney General Tom Riley was going to serve him a subpoena to go before a grand jury investigation. Mm-hmm. What we didn't know then, Marco, was that he was not being punished by the Vatican. He was being rescued by the Vatican. He got sanctuary there and was kept in a place of stature and respect. And the reason for that is that we now know that Cardinal Law was merely carrying out orders from the Vatican itself. He was not the architect of the cover-up of sexual abuse of priests. It was the Vatican who had instructed bishops to keep these crimes secret and to protect the church from scandal at all costs. So you asked about the legal costs for the church. Cardinal Law himself never paid a price, unfortunately, but other cardinals and other bishops in the world increasingly are facing criminal charges. There has been a bishop here in the United States who in Kansas City, Missouri, who was found guilty of failing to report child sexual abuse. Two archbishops in Australia right now are undergoing prosecution for cover-up. There is a cardinal in France who is being prosecuted right now for failing to report child sexual abuse.
Well, and so, let me jump in there because I'm wondering right after the scandal that, if we can say, began here in Boston, how far and wide did it spread around the globe?
Ironically, Marco, Cardinal Law famously said right before the Boston Globe began publishing its big stories, he said philosophically, you know, the church has been on a learning curve when it comes to child sexual abuse in the church. Really, the church knew all along what it was doing. It was a very deliberately executed plan of concealment. The learning curve has been the public's. We at first thought it was a Boston problem, and then, well, maybe it's an American problem because we saw the crisis burst open in California in 2003 and spread across the country. By 2010, we understood it was a worldwide problem. We were hearing about cover-up and government investigations in Europe and South America and Canada and Australia. And that is when it became commonly recognized that the Vatican had initiated the cover-up of child sexual abuse.
So Bernard Law goes to Rome. He becomes archpriest at Santa Maria Maggiore, one of the big historic dioceses in the city. Philip, you went there a few years ago to see what life for Law was like. What did you see? What was going on?
That's right. This is 2015. Anne is pointing out, this is, again, all over the world you see people addressing, Catholics addressing the church abuse scandal. But in the Vatican, what you saw was, though he was not a rock star, he was held in great esteem. He lived in a beautiful palazzo. He was basically highly regarded by his fellow cardinals and archbishops and priests in the Vatican. Let me also mention another point about Cardinal Law that I think is really important. Not only did he know about some of these individuals, he allowed some of their actions to continue after these revelations came out. One of the more notorious acts or actors in this whole sordid affair, and Anne knows about this well, is Father Paul Shanley. Father Shanley, I should mention, is someone who left Boston in 2002, in March 2002. He was well known by the cardinal. Where he was well known, but he took off for Thailand. And what did he do in Thailand? He went to Pattaya, a resort area that is known for sex trafficking. And he basically abused boys while he was there. How do we know this? I was in Pattaya a few years ago and learned this from the Thai police. And so this abuse continued, not just in Boston, but it was it proliferated around the world. And it was something that was known to Cardinal Law.
And let's talk about what's changed since 2002, and to your point that the crisis was essentially managed by the Vatican. Pope Francis comes along in 2013. He represents a new mindset, immensely popular around the world. But today, he's announced that he's going to be attending Law's funeral. How well has Francis really done to put this whole thing to rest?
Pope Francis was the first pope ever to say the words, "Bishops must be held accountable." But Marco, he's been a huge disappointment when it comes to actual results. He has belatedly taken a few bishops out of their positions after they caused enormous scandal and outrage of the public. But his predecessors did the same thing. He never so much as said a disapproving word about Cardinal Law one of his first acts of Pope actually was to concelebrate a mass with Cardinal Law in Rome. He is keeping known enablers in high positions in the church. So Pope Francis, unfortunately, although he is progressive and a breath of fresh air on a number of issues, has not delivered on this really crucial issue of getting rid of bishops who cover up for priests.
But one of the first things Pope Francis did was create this Commission for the Protection of Minors. Are you saying that it's led to no change at all?
It's led to no significant change. In fact, that very commission, in the last few days, we've learned that he's letting it go fallow. It's essentially entered a hibernation period. But I will say this, in terms of hopefulness, all the public pressure that built in 2002 as a result of the documents being released in Boston and elsewhere resulted in the U.S. bishops passing strict reform measures. And to this day, the U.S. Catholic Church has stricter policies for removing abusers than any other church in the world. They are still fall far short, and the policy itself has loopholes. So it's by no means have we achieved a perfect state here in the United States. But the U.S. bishops did enact a more rigorous measure for investigating and removing abusive priests.
You know, it occurs to me that Bernard Law dies in the middle of another raft of scandalous revelations, in this case, men preying upon women, especially in the workplace.
Yes.
And power structures protecting those men from punishment for ages. For both of you, does the death of Law connect to this other set of abuses of power, or do you see his legacy as somehow different?
Without question, these things are connected. They're concomitant. You cannot divorce the issue of sexual harassment from other predatory type of behavior. And the Catholic Church during this regime of Cardinal Law helped encourage that, unfortunately. One of the great ironies is that you see a Pope Francis, who indeed is progressive on many issues, including climate change and human trafficking. The reason I went to the Vatican was basically to report on those issues and how he's leading on those issues. So it seems somewhat extraordinary that though he's led on the issue of human trafficking around the world, the ultimate form of abuse, but has basically refrained from carrying out his duties. And it is a duty to rein in and to do right by the victims of sexual abuse, that he's basically fallen down on that.
Anne Barrett Doyle, what do you think?
I totally agree with Philip. There is a really direct connection between the revelations about Cardinal Law here in Boston and the revelations that are happening today about abuse of women across many industries and sectors of society. Thanks to those survivors who came forward in 2002 and 2003, thanks to the exposure of the documents, which were proof, we now more tend to believe victims. Victims can come forward knowing that they won't be automatically pilloried and disbelieved. We now understand the phenomenon of institutional cover-up. We understand the phenomenon of why an abuser can be popular and stay in power and yet still have a series of victims throughout his career. All those things that seem preposterous at first, we learned from the victims of clergy sexual abuse starting here in Boston and now sadly across the world. And we have them to thank, I think, for the tremendous transparency that's happening today in terms of sexual harassment of women.
Anne Barrett Doyle with Bishop Accountability and reporter Philip Martin, my colleague here at WGBH. Thank you both very much for weighing in on this.
Thank you, Marco.
Marco, you're so welcome. Thank you.
Coming up, a Rhode Island company stands up to the winds of globalization in the market for costume jewelry. That's just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Let's talk jewelry. Not the Cartier kind, but the affordable stuff, you know, costume jewelry. It's just one of the many industries in the U.S. that's been disrupted by globalization. That's the thrust of our 50 States project here at The World, how globalization is changing the way we work and live in the U.S. Today, we're focusing our 50 States lens on Rhode Island, which for decades was the place to be for costume jewelry. Not so much anymore, but we found one Rhode Island company that's standing its ground. Here's my WGBH colleague, Edgar B. Herwick III.
There are more chains, beads, and pendants than you can imagine inside this industrial building in East Providence. Designers sit at artfully cluttered desks, sketching with pencil on paper. Hundreds of metal baubles stew in metal vats being cleaned and polished. And George Cantara sits at one of a few dozen hulking orange and green machines with a tweezers, plucking and placing delicate steel hoops.
So I strike these pieces. I put the piece right there in the middle. Put the two buttons at the same time.
And there you have it.
Yeah.
Ed DeCristofaro, who now runs this company, LDC, that his father started more than 30 years ago, explains what's happening here.
It's a steel hoop that we're embossing a pattern in the bottom of. Back in the late 80s and early 90s, we made all of these dies with different patterns. If you look on the shelf behind you.
Holy smoke.
And it's hand-done one at a time.
One at a time.
Hand-done.
Yep.
It's sort of shocking to me. These made-in-the-USA hoop earrings are what's called fashion jewelry or costume jewelry, the inexpensive to medium-priced bracelets or bangles you might buy at a mall kiosk or from a retailer like J. Crew or Ann Taylor. For much of the 20th century, if you were buying these kind of adornments, chances are they were made in Rhode Island.
Providence was once the jewelry capital of the world, absolutely positively the jewelry capital of the world, fashion jewelry capital of the world.
In the mid-1980s, America's smallest state boasted some 25,000 jewelry workers at 900 companies pumping out a million pieces of jewelry a week, about 80% of all fashion jewelry manufactured in the country.
It's a very, very hard-working industry. No one in this industry makes money without working hard, and no one survives without working very hard.
To hear DeCristofaro talk about the industry he's been in since the age of 15 is a bit like listening to a Bruce Springsteen song.
Most model makers were third and fourth generation. You know, their great-grandfathers, their grandfathers, their fathers were model makers. What were they going to be? A model maker was easy. It was already predetermined for them. They were going to do it. And it provided them good livings.
And true to the Springsteen form, the hard times came. The post-NAFTA exodus and the rise of cheap manufacturing overseas that devastated the industry.
The industry changed. They worked as hard as they could and still changed on them. You know, some of these guys, they were older, and they just kept looking at us, wow, it's leaving.
But DeCristofaro was still young and determined that LDC could survive. And that meant changing, too.
It was a constant evolution. So we started making tools and dies for people, and as that business was changing, we started making component parts and pieces and selling those to other manufacturers.
Today, a nimble company of 40 employees, they do it all. Their chief business is the design and manufacture of finished jewelry products for name brand retailers. Executive Vice President Jennifer Brousseau explains.
Most women out there probably own many, many pairs of LDC hoops, but they just don't know it. They've been wearing it under another brand name.
They're able to compete with cheaper overseas companies, in part because some customers want made in the USA. And some just want fast turnaround, says sales director Alexis Garapi.
A lot of other places I've worked before, you worked with a lot of overseas vendors. You weren't able to be quick with things. LDC is very quick. It's a huge, huge selling point for us.
But retail is also transforming. And so LDC's newest evolution is their own line. Alexis Ryan, sold direct to consumers, primarily online.
It's a simple line with clean, recognizable icons for pendants. And the comfort was really important to us.
And affordable. Yeah. We wanted to make sure we were affordable.
And to keep it affordable, much of the Alexis Ryan line is made overseas.
This is the team that's the conduit between us and China. So after it's developed, designed, this team then takes it over.
Such is the picture of 21st century manufacturing in America. Products manufactured in China to help keep an American company afloat so they can make other products right here in the U.S. As for whether jewelry's future in Rhode Island looks as bright as its glory days, maybe not. But DeCristofaro says this is still the place to be.
There's new energy in it, but you've got to go find the new energy. It's not going to come to you. You really need the core competencies, and they are here. So the finishers are here, the platers are here, some of the stone suppliers, they're still here. You need to be here.
For the world, Edgar B. Herwick III, East Providence, Rhode Island.
Here's a great story about a moose that is not here in New England.
Ferdinand is a magnificent moose. He's big, he's all white, he has huge antlers.
That's Hans Nielsen speaking to our colleagues at the BBC. Nielsen is an amateur wildlife photographer, and he's made Ferdinand a celebrity in his home country of Sweden. Ferdinand is one of about 100 white moose living there. Their rare white color comes from a genetic mutation. Nielsen heard about this white moose because when Ferdinand was a calf, his mom died, and there was a story going around about how villagers kept him alive by feeding him fresh branches.
I've seen lions and elephants, and here I have something spectacular right near where I live. Of course, I want to see that too.
Nielsen looked for Ferdinand for 3 years. No luck. Until
Friday, August the 11th, I was at work, and I was thinking, should I go to a lake and have a swim, or should I go and see if I can spot a moose? And luckily, I decided to try to find a moose.
And that was when Nielsen finally found Ferdinand, out in the woods. He watched him jump into a stream, shake himself off.
And then he looked straight in the camera, like he was saying to me, did you get all that, or do you want me to do it again?
He posted a video of the encounter, and it went viral. Oh, but how quickly fame can turn sour. Last month, Ferdinand stumbled into some trouble.
Ferdinand is living in a forest where there are farms and houses. And on a particular day, a lady was out with her two dogs.
And the dogs just happened to be tied around this lady's waist.
And then suddenly Ferdinand turned up there.
The dogs barked at Ferdinand. Ferdinand attacked the dogs, and the lady with the dogs tied around her waist got caught in the middle.
She was dragged to the ground and dislocated her shoulder.
The police decided that Ferdinand would have to go. They gave hunters permission to shoot him, and Nielsen was devastated. He started a petition to save Ferdinand, and it got thousands of signatures.
The next day, I got a phone call from one of the national newspapers. He wanted to ask me about my reaction that the life of Ferdinand was spared. I said, is it true? Because I hadn't heard about it. Yes?
Yes, it was true. Ferdinand's life was spared. Now it seems everything's back to normal for the white moose. Hans Nielsen says he sometimes sees Ferdinand out in the woods, chomping grass and not bothering anyone at all. So when's the children's book coming out? By the way, you can watch that viral video of Ferdinand taking a dip in a stream. That's up on our Facebook page right now. Just search for PRI The World. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, the paintings of a former prisoner at Guantanamo Bay and why he liked to paint the sea.
I imagine my life in the Guantanamo like I am in the sea, in the middle of the sea. And I imagine one day maybe the boat will come and I will go out.
The art of Gitmo prisoners, still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. 1,000 days ago, on March 26, 2015, the U.S. got wrapped up in a civil war 7,000 miles away. It was that day that a coalition of Arab countries led by Saudi Arabia began a bombing campaign in Yemen with support from the United States and Great Britain. The effort was meant to stop a rebel movement from taking over the country on Saudi Arabia's southern border. 1,000 days later, thousands of civilians have been killed, close to 1 million infected with cholera, and 2/3 of the country's people don't have enough to eat. And the war in Yemen shows no sign of stopping. Reporter Iona Craig lived in Yemen before the war. She's been in and out as the fighting has continued, and she's seen how it's taken its toll on people throughout the country.
Everybody is just struggling really to get by these days. The government wages haven't been paid since August of last year. All of those people, whether they were working in hospitals or as civil servants for the government, now essentially don't have jobs. Even if they're going to work, they're not getting paid. Although in some places it's almost become normalized, this kind of level of violence, and everybody is exhausted with it, whether they're in the north or in the south. I know a lot of people don't always see this as a civil war, but it started as that. That north-south divide that kind of goes back to the two previous states, really, of Yemen when they were two separate countries prior to 1990. This war has opened up a lot of those old wounds. It's affecting people on both sides of that front line, if you like. The infrastructure has been massively affected. There's, you know, water shortages in many places across the country. There's fuel shortages. Even in the coalition-controlled city of Aden in the south, the electricity is very bad when you're there, and it's sort of it's raging heat in the middle of their hottest periods, and there's no air conditioning and no electricity, or whether you're in a place like Tyres that hasn't had proper water supplies for 2.5 years now, and the fighting is just relentless every night from sort of sunset until after dawn.
Iona, you know people in the south of Yemen, in the north of Yemen, probably people who don't agree politically. How does it feel to be friends with both sides, and what do you see happening after this war?
It's can be interesting having friends on both sides, because you get to see obviously both perspectives, but also in a very Yemeni way. I've had southern friends meet with northern friends, particularly when they've been helping me get across the country. And I sort of had this handover process where I go from the southerners who help me to the northerners. But in a very Yemeni way, they will sit down and discuss politics for a couple of hours. And that's very indicative of Yemeni culture, really, that even in times of conflict, even in times of war, people will sit down and mediate or discuss politics or come together in some shape or form. And that's really why I think it's so important to try and remove the international and regional element of the Saudi-led coalition out of the conflict, because I think there's more prospect and more hope for Yemenis themselves to find a solution internally in Yemen when that international aspect is no longer involved.
Let's get back to the coalition and the foreign partners with Saudi Arabia in this war. Why is the government of your country, the UK, and to an even greater extent, the United States, why are they involved? What is exactly their role in this war?
Well, of course, they support the Saudi-led coalition, both the UK and the US, strong allies of Saudi Arabia. But more importantly, on the logistics front and on the weapons supplies, the Saudi coalition has had this support from the US and the UK. I mean, the UK in weapons sales have soared in the period of the war, of course, because the Saudi coalition now have this, you know, constant appetite for more bombs needed for the air war and for the bombing campaign. The US is even more involved because they're actually making it logistically possible for those air raids to be carried out. They're providing fuel to the Saudi-led coalition fighter jets that are carrying out bombing raids on a daily basis. Without those fuel supplies, they wouldn't be able to carry out those air raids. So they're particularly crucial to that.
So today, more than 3 years since the beginning of this war, what do you tell people about what's going on? People who are not familiar with Yemen, how do you explain what's at stake?
Well, really, I suppose the priority now is the humanitarian crisis. And it's really about explaining to people how that is entirely man-made. That Yemen, yes, was the poorest country in the Middle East before this conflict, but now there is a situation of mass starvation and potential mass famine for millions of Yemenis who have no involvement in this conflict whatsoever. And that is being instigated by the Saudi-led coalition, who are supported by our own governments here in the West. And I think that's the most important thing for people to understand, that we are all complicit in this.
Iona, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Maybe someday we'll see the artistic dividends that the trauma of war in Yemen may produce. Right now in New York, we're seeing the art of trauma in detention. A new show at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City is generating intense reactions because it features artwork produced by prisoners at the U.S. Navy base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. One of the pieces is even by a prisoner on trial for his alleged role in the 9/11 attacks. My WGBH colleague Arun Roth has been following the story since he saw some detainee art last year on a reporting trip to Guantanamo. So he went to New York to see the show.
Ammar al-Baluchi is on trial in a military commission in Guantanamo Bay for his role in supporting the 9/11 attacks. Today, a piece of his artwork is on display not far from where the Twin Towers fell. The abstract watercolor reflects his torture at the hands of the CIA. It's called Vertigo.
It's just a swirl of lines and dots, and he drew it to show his lawyers what happens when he experiences vertigo, when he can no longer see, which is a result of an injury he suffered during interrogation.
Erin Thompson is an art professor at John Jay and curator of the show. She studied the intersection of art and criminal behavior, but was surprised to hear that War on Terror detainees were making art.
One of the lawyers for detainees approached me and said, I want my client's art to be exhibited. And I said, what do you mean there's art made at Guantanamo? And she took me to her office and just opened file cabinets full of paintings in her law office in Midtown Manhattan and showed me all these images of the sea created by her clients.
Turns out there was a lot of art in the hands of various lawyers, gifts from prisoners they represented in review boards and military commissions. Most of them, unlike Amar al-Baluchi, were not considered high-value detainees, and four of the artists with work in the show were released under President Obama. Aliyah Hussein is a lawyer for the Center for Constitutional Rights, which represents a number of Guantanamo detainees.
We've developed very close relationships with our clients. We're really their only connection to the outside world.
The art is a mix of watercolor, acrylic, and mixed media, reflecting the limitations placed on the artists by prison conditions. They don't get tools like X-Acto knives, for instance. Sculptures that appear to be made out of wood, including some incredible model ships, are actually cardboard stained with coffee grounds, sails made of old shirts fixed with glue, rigging from unraveled prayer caps. The title to the exhibit, Ode to the Sea, is a nod to the pervasive images of the ocean in the artwork, sometimes peaceful, other times ominous with shark fins or ships violently wrecked. There's more than one depiction of the Titanic.
Mohamed Ansi has a painting of the Titanic in the show, which is because in his first interrogation with a female interrogator, they showed him the movie Titanic to try and create rapport with this interrogator.
Ansi was in the last group of detainees released by President Obama just days before Donald Trump took office. Another former detainee, Abdul Malik al-Rahabi, painted scenes of a city by the water, a suspension bridge at sunset.
I imagine my life in the Guantanamo like I am in the sea, in the middle of the sea. When I think about that, I think about the sea, you know, it's big sea. And I imagine one day maybe the boat will come, ship, you know, they will come and take you outside. One day I will go out.
Al-Rahabi did get out. He lives in Montenegro now. We spoke over Skype, and he showed me many more paintings he produced in Gitmo that he now hopes to sell. Aaron Thompson understands some people might find that disturbing and that this art could elicit sympathy for the detainees. But she says the show serves a function for everyone.
To me, the show is of interest no matter what side you fall on, no matter what you believe about these men. Is it that you want to see the humanity of them as victims, or do you want to understand better the enemy? You can do either by looking at these works.
The show has still triggered some controversy. Upon learning that some of the detainee artwork in the exhibit was for sale, the Department of Defense stopped the transfer of artwork out of the facility and clarified that items produced by detainees remain the property of the government. The Pentagon says they will not attempt to reclaim the art in the exhibit and that reports that detainee art would be destroyed are false. The exhibit, Art from Guantanamo, will run through January.
That's WGBH's Arun Roth. Imagine this photo. Two gentlemen in suit jackets meet up for a pint in a British pub. A pretty ordinary scene, but this particular photo happens to represent hundreds of millions of dollars in global business. And that's because of who these two men in the pub were. Xi Jinping, the Chinese president, and David Cameron, the former British prime minister. The picture was taken in 2015, when Cameron was still in office, but it has resurfaced in news reports because of a new arrangement between Cameron and the Chinese government. To walk us through the significance of all this, Isaac Stonefish joins me. He's a journalist and longtime China watcher. So tell us how that meeting in a pub, Isaac, is connected to David Cameron's new job.
Now Cameron will be running a billion-dollar investment fund that is part of China's global infrastructure project, One Belt, One Road. And the connections that Cameron made while prime minister of the UK enabled the Chinese to decide, hey, I think he's a good face for our global infrastructure project.
So what is new about this move by David Cameron?
It's very strange for a former head of a Western government to go and work for the Chinese Communist Party. I don't think that it's happened before, and it really shows just how legitimate the party has become in the eyes of the West, or looked at in perhaps a less charitable way, just how much money people are willing to make to overlook certain issues with the party's human rights record, for example.
So he'll be getting a paycheck from the government in Beijing?
I don't know exactly how they're going to structure the deal, but the Communist Party is his boss for this fund.
Have you heard what reaction is to this in the UK? Like, are people upset that seemingly Cameron had access to Chinese power as the prime minister and now he's got this job managing a $1 billion investment fund?
I'm not there, but from what I've heard, it's been shockingly muted, especially considering how much criticism former Prime Minister Tony Blair got when he shilled for the government of Kazakhstan. So it's really just striking to me and a lot of other people who follow China to see, wow, I guess it's now considered socially acceptable among the ex-government elite to go and work for Beijing.
So let's pull back a little bit, because Great Britain is leaving the EU, the whole Brexit thing. Doesn't it make a little sense that the Brits would want to expand trade with a rising power like China, a power outside of Europe?
That's the China paradox in a way. It almost always makes sense to trade with China. It's a massive economy. There's a lot of really distinct and good benefits for a country enriching its trade with China. But trading with China at that level comes with costs. And part of the costs is that you're forced to legitimize the Chinese Communist Party. And you're forced to, in some ways, legitimize some of the things that they've done and some of the things that they stand for.
So what do you think is in this deal for China with the former British Prime Minister?
I think the PR for this is amazing. It almost really doesn't matter what they're paying him. They got him for cheap. You know, the idea that a former head of state of the United Kingdom is now at a fairly junior level in the Chinese system. Xi Jinping has said that this would be roughly a $100 billion investment, and the fund that Cameron runs has, as of now, about $1 billion in it. So it's just a small portion of one of China's global initiatives. It's just an amazing thing when you look at the people at the top of the party, and then you go down a few levels, and oh, there's David Cameron.
Mm. And what do you think Cameron is going to kind of focus this $1 billion investments in? Is it infrastructure?
A lot of it's going to be in infrastructure. And I imagine that, frankly, if he doesn't really do anything and just lends his name to it, then that's enough for what Beijing wants. I don't think details have come out yet on exactly what he's going to do. But just showing up at events, shaking some hands, scheduling some meetings, I think would be plenty.
You know as well as anyone, Isaac, it wasn't that long ago when China was a fully socialist, centrally controlled economy with really less interest in flexing its muscle on the global stage. That has obviously changed. So what is the symbolic significance of someone like David Cameron, a former prime minister of the UK, essentially becoming an employee of the Chinese government?
The symbolism is so rich. The Communist Party loves to talk about the century of humiliation, which is what they call a period from the Opium Wars. In the 1800s, Britain came in and then a few decades later destroyed the emperor's summer palace and caused a great shame on the Chinese nation, as the party sees it, up until the Japanese invasion. And now the same United Kingdom is sending one of its former heads of state to serve the party. You know, it's just such a gift to the party, unlike any I've seen in quite some time.
Isaac Stonefish is a reporter and a fellow at the Asia Society. Always good to speak with you, Isaac. Thanks.
Great to chat, Marco.
Here's a follow-up to a story we've been tracking for you. A man known as Eaton Fish, which is not his real name. It's the pen name of the Iranian cartoonist Ali Durrani. We've reported in the past on the years Durrani spent stuck on Manus Island, one of Australia's controversial offshore detention camps in Papua New Guinea, and the support he's gotten from political cartoonists around the world using the hashtag @afish. Now, after more than 4 years, Eaton Fish has been released and given refuge in a so far unnamed city in Northern Europe. He got there through the help of the International Cities of Refuge Network, or ICORN. It's an organization that works to offer shelter, safety, and new homes for writers and artists at risk. Eaton Fish will get an apartment, a monthly stipend, and care and counseling for his PTSD and his intense obsessive compulsive disorder. Perhaps most importantly, he'll get the ability to continue his work as a cartoonist. The Party of Nelson Mandela, that is one heck of a brand. But for a long time now in South Africa, the ANC, the African National Congress, has disappointed a lot of its supporters. This week, the ANC held elections to choose its new leader and likely South Africa's next president, given the ANC's dominance. The winner?
We declare Comrade Cyril Ramaphosa as the new president of the African National Congress.
Cyril Ramaphosa will take the party reins from Jacob Zuma, a man whose tenure as president of South Africa has been marked by corruption scandals and abuse of power. Ramaphosa narrowly beat Zuma's ex-wife for control of the ANC. His victory is seen as a win for party reformers, up to a point. Ramaphosa is a longtime ANC figure who largely stayed silent about corruption, and he's not seen as an agent of change. So there's still a lot of disenchantment with the ANC, especially among South Africa's young middle class.
Many of us have been left to feel disgruntled about the status quo of the party and the leadership.
We contacted two young South African women who grew up with the ANC.
I'm Musidi Modise. I am from Cape Town, but originally from the Free State in South Africa. You know, we actually, as a family, have quite close ties with the ANC. So my mom, I think 10 years ago or so, she worked quite closely at Luthuli House. She was managing the finances there. So we grew up in a house where we ate and slept ANC. So it was in the time where Thabo Mbeki was still the president, and then Nelson Mandela had just transitioned and put a good solid foundation for the party. And they had a lot of teething issues then, but those days were much better. There was a lot of hope. There was a lot of commitment. And also very inclusive, whether you're black or white. At this point in time, the perception of it is like, as a young person, I wouldn't want to affiliate myself with a party because it's a representative of nepotism, cronyism, and abject corruption. And the perception of the ANC or the brand ANC has been tarnished, I believe, from the days when my mom was still there, actively involved in the party, to what it is now.
My name is Aratni Pillay. I live in Johannesburg, South Africa. The ANC today is such a shell compared to what it once was as a mighty liberation movement. Some of my clearest memories are as a 10-year-old watching our first democratic elections take place and having complete FOMO watching my parents going off to vote and, you know, really wanting to know who they voted for, wishing I could have been in the booth with them, and reading the new constitution as a young teenager cover to cover. So, there really is a sense of sadness of where the ANC finds itself now, particularly because there hasn't been, in my experience and in my sense, an opposition party that has really inspired me in terms of its ideology, its leaders, its outlook. From a personal point of view, it's really sad to see what the ANC has become, because they had sort of a moral kind of authority about them that we all sort of looked up to. They were the party that had managed to get us our freedom. They were the party that had led the struggle for our freedom, that had managed to bring about our freedom with very little bloodshed in many ways, although there was some. And so it's deeply sad. It's deeply sad to see them reduced and captured. We talk about state capture as a country, but the party itself has been captured by some nefarious people, and that is very sad to see.
South Africans Varashni Pillay and Mosidi Modise giving us their take on the state of the country's governing African National Congress. 6 decades is a long time for a singer to keep at it after their biggest hit, but that's how long Petula Clark has been at it since Downtown topped the charts for her in 1965. Today, Petula Clark is 85. She won't mind me saying that. It's a sign of her staying power. Her voice was first heard during World War II when she was 9 years old and sang a tune to cheer up the British troops fighting overseas. Then, of course, the 60s when she rode the wave of the British invasion to the U.S. Fast forward to the present, and Petula Clark's come out with her 62nd album, Living for Today.
Hey, I got something to say. Don't blow me away, 'cause I'm gonna say it anyway. I'm living for today. Just living for today. Tomorrow never comes anyway, so I'm living for today.
One thing that I find remarkable is that Petula Clark has never gone on a full-blown tour of the United States until now.
Well, I suppose it is a bit surprising. You know, when it all exploded for me over here in 1965 with Downtown and etc., I mean, it was lovely, but I already had a big, big career going on in Europe. I also had two small children. So when America happened, it was fantastic, of course, but it complicated my life somewhat. And there were a lot of things I just couldn't do. I couldn't go off on tour all over America. It was just out of the question. So, you know, I did Vegas because that meant we could take the children with us, you know, for a couple of weeks or three weeks. And it was like a vacation for them. And I did concerts here and there, but I never did an actual tour. So, this is the first time I've done a tour. And it's a bus tour, what's more, which is something that I have never done ever. And it's quite an experience, I'll tell you that.
Does everyone want to hear Downtown, and do you gladly oblige, or does it get a little old after a while?
You know, it's a song that it just goes on, and, you know, I sing it in my show, obviously. And as soon as they hear those first notes on the piano, that's it. You know, they're gone. They've gone wild, and they're joining in with me. And I never get bored with it because it's a darn good song.
When you're alone and life is making you lonely, you can always go downtown.
Considering what a global smash it was, I always wondered what the chorus means to someone in a city that doesn't really have a downtown.
I tell you what, I mean, it's been a hit in so many different countries where probably downtown doesn't quite exist the way it does in America. I think they just like the idea of it. They like the image of downtown. And, of course, above all, they love the song. I mean, that melody is known all over the world.
Petula Clark is now winding down her U.S. tour. If you missed it, we'll leave you with a taste of what she sounds like today, a track from her new album that harkens back to that British invasion of the mid-60s.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night.
Petula Clark covering the Beatles' Blackbird. It'll do it for us today. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. See you tomorrow.
You were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see. All your life, you were only waiting for this moment to be free.
PRI, Public Radio International.